this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Nate Wheezy of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Mora National Fish Hatchery about his work in recovering Gila trout in New Mexico. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/FisheriesPodcast. Our guest today is Nate Wheezy. Nate grew up in northern Wisconsin chasing muskies and other outdoor adventures. In high school, he found an opportunity to volunteer at the Bullfrog Fish Farm rearing rainbow trout. That experience led him to the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, to finish a bachelor's degree in fisheries biology in 2001. After college, he couldn't find a job in the cold winters of the North, so he took a graduate assistantship at the University of Arkansas Pine Bluff, where he completed a master's degree in aquaculture and fisheries, rearing channel catfish and studying hedonic price analysis of commercial catfish pricing. After graduating, he worked a short stint with the North Dakota Game and Fish Department, before moving on to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Hagerman National Fish Hatchery in 2004, where he reared steelhead trout for the Snake River in Idaho. Nate has since bounced around to various national fish hatcheries and is currently the hatchery manager at Mora National Fish Hatchery in New Mexico. Welcome to the podcast, Nate.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Nick.
Some management folk kind of joke around about hatchery math being kind of a questionable area, but hedonic price analysis sounds pretty complicated. How did you use that to look at commercial catfish industry?
Yeah, you know, I came out of an undergrad program of fishery science, and I'd done several stints working the aquaculture program at Bullfrog Fish Farm. I had a blast, and then also with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, I realized I'm going to need a master's degree to get anywhere in this field. And so the opportunity opened up down at University of Arkansas Pine Bluff, and they said it's hedonic price analysis. I said, I have no idea what that is, but I'm all in. And, you know, basically hedonic price analysis is in the study of econometrics. And econometrics looks at buying habits of consumers, but it does it with a modeling approach and a statistical model where we can take different patterns of consumers. And in this case, it was catfish buyers. So the big commercial catfish buyers, we can look at what you're actually setting the market for. In the case of catfish pricing, a lot of times it looks at the size range of the fish, if the fish are hitting the right market size, how many trash fish are in there, and the quality of fish. And so by analyzing that, we can help the catfish farmers come up with a better product for the market. It's super fascinating line of work outside of what you normally do in fisheries management.
So is your master's work more looking at the data that the commercial growers will give you, or were you out there kind of sifting through some of their fish, measuring them, and seeing how much of those trash fish were in there with them?
I got to do a little of both. You know, a lot of it was data manipulate or looking at data sets that we could get. Of course, data sets on the farm were usually, you know, a file set of 10-year stacks of load receipts from the catfish plant. So a lot of it was just entering data. But then, yeah, I had a lot of opportunity to go right on the farm. And you know, catfish farming is a pretty neat operation. Usually big 10-acre ponds. You stand up a pond with a couple of tractors and start loading, you know, tens of thousands of pounds of catfish onto a truck. Part of that work started looking at more intensive type of grading operations. Normally you'd stake those catfish out in a live car with a certain mesh size and let the small fish swim out. And they started looking at actual bar graders for those with actively pumping the catfish over the top of bars. That type of technology has worked really well for trout aquaculture over the years. But a catfish, of course, have those big spines that stick out the side. And when you put a catfish on a bar, they'll stick those out and don't fall through, at least consistently. And the technology was where you actually flood the bars with a pump, keep those fish under the water, and they will always try to swim down through them, and you can grade them out effectively. So really fascinating stuff, and has really dialed in the commercial sector.
So after graduating, you then went off to North Dakota before bouncing around the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. What are some of the different locations that you've been fortunate enough to work in?
You know, I've been permanently stationed in several places. I started out in Hagerman, Idaho, which is right in the heart of commercial aquaculture, but also has four major state and federal hatchery producers that produce a lot of salmon and steelhead for the state of Idaho. Really great area to be in as far as just seeing the aquaculture business and the amount of spring water supply that comes out of that big Snake River Plain aquifer that starts right up in Yellowstone Park and dumps out in central Idaho into the Snake River. From there, I bounced up to Dorshak Hatchery, which is up in northern Idaho. And they're one of the largest U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service salmon and steelhead producers, basically a mitigation program for the Lower Snake Compensation Plan dams there up on the Snake River. So trying to mitigate some of our hydropower effects up there on the river. The nice thing about the Fish and Wildlife Service is we're national. So between those stints, I bounced all over the place, did some work out in Washington, D.C. on fisheries mitigation work in the southeast region, working on how we get dollars from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and funnel them back to the Fish and Wildlife Service for these big hydropower projects in the southeast. Went out to Macaw National Fish Hatchery for a while, which is way out on that western tip of Washington State. One of the rainiest places I've ever lived. It's like 160 inches of rain a year and absolutely beautiful. They're doing some mitigation work with the tribe, putting in summer steelhead, some coho and Chinook. And then helped out at several other hatcheries and finally landed down here at Mora National Fish Hatchery as the project leader. And our big mission here is recovering Gila trout. It's an incredible project.
And you just mentioned that you're currently working with Gila trout. I've mentioned before in previous episodes that I grew up never seeing a trout in southwest Iowa and now work in a state with no native trout. And that definitely includes the Gila trout. Could you describe the Gila trout to someone like myself who has never seen one?
Yeah, well, I mean, basically you're looking at the most beautiful fish in the world, and I'm just a little biased, but a Gila trout is a lot like a rainbow trout. I think a lot of wranglers are familiar with rainbow trout, but you're talking about a fish well adapted to these cold mountain streams. So they're real streamlined, a body shape that's going to be able to deal with high flows in the spring. And navigate between rocks, constantly looking for, you know, any type of food that's available, small midges, aquatic inverts coming down, and occasional fish. So the Gila trout are fascinating to me because they're direct descendants of rainbow trout, and most specifically anadromous steelhead, that got kind of stranded up here in the Gila River drainage of New Mexico. And that Gila River drains all the way from New Mexico past Phoenix all the way out to the Colorado River and eventually the Sea of Cortez. The Gila trout itself, as it kind of moved away from rainbow trout, took on this real bronze color, almost like the color of the sun during a real orange bronze sunset. It's just absolutely stunning. And they kind of lost that red crimson stripe of the rainbow, but are still speckled with real fine black spots that a rainbow trout would have. When they're young fish, they can be easily confused, but as they mature to sexual maturity, you'll start to see this real bronze color, almost of a brown trout, or the same bronze you see actually in a common carp, with very small scales as a trout. Their last kind of strongholds in the Gila River are up in these high mountain streams, and so fishing for them is really an experience. It's not just catching a fish, but just the adventure of getting to where these fish live. Really the most southernmost parts of southernmost range of trout we have in North America almost.
Since you have taken over at Mora National Fish Hatchery, production of Gila trout has increased roughly 1,400% from 20,000 to 280,000 in 5 years. Is this just coincidence, or what are some of the factors that have led to that increase?
Our team here has had a great string of successes lately. It's really built on all the past experience we've started to put together at Mora Fish Hatchery. You know, the Gila trout has been tried off and on in captivity since the early 1900s. They first tried them in the 19-teens back in Glenwood Hatchery in southern New Mexico, and they were looking for a fish supplement the fishery. They never really had much success, and so they quickly changed over to rainbow trout, which were becoming more and more common across the country. And then we kind of kept dabbling in them between New Mexico Game and Fish and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service throughout the 40s and 50s, and then they were finally listed as endangered there in the 70s. Mora Fish Hatchery didn't get on started until 1998, brought the Gila trout on the early 2000s. And with very limited experience, it's taken a lot of years to kind of gain the experience and to dial the hatchery in to really be a suitable place for these fish. Now that we've got it kind of dialed in, that they've really taken off, and we're able to have a lot of fish available to supply to both the recovery effort, and then we also supply surplus fish to our broodstock and recovery effort to recreational fishing opportunities in Arizona and New Mexico.
In the future, when this project with the Gila trout reintroduction or reestablishment starts to reach some of its goals, how many different streams or how wide of an area are these fish going to be found in throughout New Mexico and the Southwest?
Yeah, you know, they have a limited range, but our recovery goals are almost 280 kilometers. So we're about halfway there. So 280 kilometers of occupied habitat. I've seen estimates of Gila trout in the wild is about 39,000 fish. So as you just mentioned, there's 280,000 fish from the hatchery. Those numbers are going up. Some of the fish, there's not room for the habitat that we have, so they'll go into recreational fishery programs and end up displacing some of our rainbow trout. But eventually, you'll have quite a few opportunities, I think, to find a spot to go explore and possibly catch a Gila trout in the Southwest.
All right, and you mentioned in your previous answer that you and the previous staff there at Mora have really learned a lot about how to rear these fish, and you've kind of starting to hit a stride here recently, producing almost 300,000 fish, but you're still at work trying to make it a more efficient process, trying to make them better fish. And you and your staff are experimenting with circular tank rearing, and I guess all two of the trout hatcheries that I've ever stepped foot in use only raceways, or I've only seen raceways. So I guess how is raising trout in circular tanks different?
Yeah, that's a great question, Nick. You know, this is something that's really excites me about Mora and its the opportunities we have. We've been experimenting with circular tanks, and circular tanks were designed for a system like Mora that's a fully recirculating system, mostly to remove solids from the system. So you can envision these kind of classic long raceway runs where we raise fish. Solids kind of tend to accumulate. Sometimes we collect them in what we call quiescent zones, where we screen the fish out and have a place for solids to settle. But the solids are still kind of trapped in there with the fish. The whole concept of the circular tank was when we put the fish in a circle, it's almost like a toilet bowl, right? We can constantly be flushing fish waste out and away from these, especially sensitive fish like trout that can't stand very high ammonia rates. So the original design was for flushing solids out, almost like a constantly flushing toilet bowl. But the secondary benefit has been that the fish are swimming. If you can envision, that toilet bowl is always spinning, so the fish are swimming against that velocity. And originally, the commercial trout producers saw this as a benefit, because if you make the fish swim more, we, instead of having a fish that has a high body fat percentage, we produce more muscle. And the more muscle means a higher fillet yield. And higher fillet yield, of course, means more dollars in your pocket. However, what we've seen in the conservation side of things is that a fish that's constantly swimming, you know, that fish has more muscle and is a faster sprinter when we're talking about getting food, when we're talking about migrating and things like that. So some of the early research in the Northwest on this was showing basically what we call smolt to adult return rates, almost double previous numbers. Where instead of having this lazy couch potato fish that lays, you know, kind of sits in a raceway, i.e. a pool, sits on his couch and we throw him fish food all day, he's not that well adapted to swim to the rigors of the wild. We take a fish that has to swim 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we've dialed that in to where we'll actually run those tanks at two body lengths a second. That fish is practically an Olympic swimmer when it goes out there and hits the wild, and is a lot more suited to getting out there, catching prey, surviving in those wild conditions. You know, I'm 6'4", so running two body lengths a second, that's like me going, making 5-minute miles. That's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It's pretty impressive. I like in the analogy of, you know, if I sat on a couch in college for a whole year and somebody just dropped Doritos through the ceiling and I got to watch TV, I'd probably do it. But then he dropped me on the Boston Marathon, I probably wouldn't go very far. I'd make it a quarter mile and sit down and wait for more Doritos. That's what sometimes I think happens to our hatchery fish. They're used to this easy lifestyle in the hatchery and they don't know what to do in the wild. We start conditioning those fish to the rigors and you'll see a whole different improvement.
Did it take a little bit of experimenting with the inflow going into those circular tanks, trying to make them not too slow to so the sediments stay in there, and not too fast so the fish are just getting spun around?
Oh, for sure. The nice thing is you can adjust the. Usually you have a set water flow available. You know, you wish you had endless water at a fish hatchery, but you don't generally have that. And so you can adjust the angle of the water entrance into the tank to keep that tank spinning at a speed that you want. I've been fortunate. We've worked with several great graduate students recently with this directorate fellowship program we have with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they've done experimentation all the way up to 6 body lengths per second. And I'll tell you, Nick, at 6 body lengths per second, those fish are really swimming to a point that some conditions fall off. The fish seem to do all right, but they get really long and skinny, and it's a little bit further past than I think where the ideal kind of optimum seems like it's about 2 body lengths a second.
Well, it sounds like you have things rolling there at the Mora National Fish Hatchery, and things are looking up. So what's next for Gila trout?
You know, the big things on our horizon is we're getting some more help. You know, like I said, we only have so much habitat out there in the wild, but we've always looked at potentially using Gila trout and some of our other facilities to take some of the rainbow trout production and convert it over to our native species of Gila trout. So we've got 2 hatcheries coming on board. They're both with our partner agencies, Arizona Game and Fish and New Mexico Department of Game and Fish. And we're really excited about this. Both the facilities are investing quite a bit of money to convert over to Gila trout. And we just shipped about 106,000 eggs over to Canyon Creek Hatchery this spring. Those guys are really excited and their fish are hatching out, and it looks like it's going to be a good year. We got another hatchery in New Mexico, Glenwood Hatchery. They're doing a big renovation project this summer. They've been raising Gila trout for us the last couple seasons, and we've had surplus, and they're gearing up to maybe even put in an additional broodstock population. So we're the stars are starting to line up for Gila trout. They're still in a threatened status, but we think with a couple additions and maybe, you know, a couple additions of hatchery programs to kind of jumpstart things, we should really be on the road to a conservation success story down here.
And all the work that we've covered in this episode and all the work that you've done down there in New Mexico has landed a lot of eyes on you with regarding your work with Gila trout. I guess, what is it like having your face on a billboard?
You know, it's funny, Nick. I spent a lot of time this spring. We were trying to get we wanted the cover of the New Mexico Game and Fish fishing regulation to have a Gila trout. And my staff, I remember getting a call on a Friday saying, "Hey, do you guys have a headshot of a Gila trout? We want to see what we can do here to put a cover shot." And as a fish biologist, you know, I don't know that much about photography. And so I told my crew, I said, "I don't know what we got to do, but we got to make this happen." And so we spent that weekend. We had fish in aquariums. We had lights. We had the best camera we could muster, and we took a bunch of pictures. And at the meantime, I was calling one of my photographer friends, Andrew Miller, out of Denver, and he said, "Man, I think I got something that can help you out." So we got all these proofs together and sent it to the editor, and of course, he picked the one for my professional photographer friend, and it turned out fantastic. Well, if you fast forward about a week later, I got a call from one of my friends. They said, "Did you know your picture's on the billboard next to Albuquerque?" And I said, "No, I didn't." And I assumed it was this picture that was on the front cover of the fishing regs, which is just a Gila trout. And my wife was driving to Albuquerque, and she sent me that picture of my 2 kids in front of a billboard holding a Gila trout. And I thought, "Oh my gosh, I finally made it. I'm on a billboard." So yeah, pretty neat feeling. The billboards just fished New Mexico get excitement. We're holding about a, you know, 16-17 inch Gila trout just before we stocked it in the lake. And boy, it feels good to be a fish biologist seeing that stuff.
Well, Nate, thank you for filling us all in on your history with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and your work down there at Mora National Fish Hatchery. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final 5 questions. And this is a group of 5 questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
You know, it's hard for me not to say that my favorite fish isn't a Gila trout. It's had a near and dear spot to my heart for the last 5 years, and really a really cool conservation story.
All right, and you kind of bounced all over the U.S., as we mentioned. What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
You know, so far, I think my favorite memory has been just the whole experience of working in this national fish hatchery system. There is a group of dedicated people out there that every single day are just putting their hearts and souls into trying to make fisheries a better place in the country. You know, we're not always have, we may have times where we're not successful, or we're stocking fish in the wrong places, or the fish aren't doing as well as we thought. But I'll tell you, we got a group of people that keep reevaluating and relooking at what we're trying to do, and really get back to what the resource is. And I think we lose sight of that sometimes, but it's great to just be out working with people that are so dedicated and passionate about a conservation issue and something that's so dear to me of, you know, fishing and growing up fishing, and seeing that kind of being put back into the resource is just incredible.
Based off of some of your answers, you can tell that you really like your job that you're working in now, and it's a nice plus that your face is on a billboard. But if this isn't it, what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
You know, my dream location is head up to Alaska. I'm not sure what I'd like to do for work, but it's going to involve something with fishing, maybe a fishing guide. But boy, I've had a couple opportunities to be up in Alaska doing some hunting and fishing adventures, and spent a couple months up there this last summer at working. And it really is the last frontier, and really reconnects me to what, why I really got into this business. And it's just an incredible place. I'd recommend it to anybody to go visit or to go stay.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
You know, if money wasn't an issue, I'd like to take this fish hatchery that I'm working at right now, Mora Fish Hatchery. It's the newest one we have in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, finished in 98. We need to build more of these. It's absolutely incredible what we're doing here with recycling water. We recycle like 95% of our water. We're putting in solar panels to try to get to a net zero energy consumption. This is like a plug-and-play hatchery that we could put in places of conservation need across the country. So money wasn't an issue, I'd put some more moras out there on the landscape.
Finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
You know, I think it's simple. Some people fish their whole lives, and they don't even realize it's not the fish they're seeking.
Well, Nate, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and the work you're doing with Gila Trout down there in New Mexico. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
You know, Google Mora National Fish Hatchery, get on our website. We got some contact info there, and give me a call.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 39th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, some people fish their whole lives not knowing it's not the fish that they're after.